This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We dive into crime stories reported on by Odyssey radio newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. This week, we'll hear about one journalist's investigation into a century-old murder case that still haunts her hometown. First, we're going to check in on quick crime updates from coast to coast, including a case linked to a cult-like group of computer scientists, and the mistrial of a man accused of causing a massive wildfire in California last year. We'll start with a harrowing case out of Odyssey Station 1010 Winds in New York, reporting on Tuesday, June 23rd.
Three women in Bayport, a woman, her mother, and her daughter, in court, indicted on charges of torturing a 7-year-old girl to death. And the cries heard in the courtroom eventually spilled into the hallway, where family and friends struggled to come to grips with how this happened. And then those cries turned to anger, which led to a big fight right outside the courthouse. 1010 Winds reporter Sophia Hall leading us off with cries for Jordan.
I can't believe that anybody in their right mind would do something like that.
Family and friends of 7-year-old Jordan Duncan cried as they packed the courtroom. In fact, there were so many supporters, some had to remain outside in the hallway.
Heartbreaking, monstrous.
They screamed as they left, saying they do not understand how three generations of women could be accused of torturing the little girl in their custody until she died.
To miss that many days of school and no one calls CPS.
And outside the courthouse, the supporters, most wearing Jordan's favorite color pink, began fighting.
What happened out here was something stupid.
No one was injured. Sophia Hall, 1010 Winds, on 92.3 FM on Long Island.
Yeah, our court officials came outside and broke up the fight. It's unclear who started it. Meantime, we'll continue to monitor developments in this case and let you know the outcome. All three women pleaded not guilty today in court.
In Philadelphia, Odyssey station KYW News Radio also reported on a disturbing case involving family on Tuesday.
A community is reeling after Philadelphia police say a grandmother killed her granddaughter and her own sister and then shot herself yesterday afternoon. KYW's crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson has more.
Officials say Janice Picano shot her 18-year-old granddaughter who had autism and then her own 55-year-old sister, Denise Gratini, inside a home along 10th Street near Oregon, not far from the stadiums. Picano was her granddaughter's primary caregiver.
You just don't hear about things like that in this neighborhood. You know, it's just a very quiet, nice neighborhood. And I've been here 30 years. That's a shame.
Sources say the 67-year-old woman was in severe distress and called 911 to tell police what she had done before turning the gun on herself. It happened around 5:30 in the evening. They say her husband came home to find the three dead inside. Police arrived soon after to sort out what happened. Detectives are still investigating. Kristen Johansson, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
And here are two more Tuesday dispatches from KYW.
A man was shot and critically wounded outside a corner store in West Philadelphia. It was around 2 a.m. near 61st and Vine, where the guy was inside the store playing a gambling machine. He walks out. Someone gets out of a minivan and walks up to him.
At which point our victim drew his firearm, had some exchange of words with the suspect. The suspect then drew his firearm. And two shots were fired, striking the victim in the stomach.
It's Police Captain Timothy Steffen. He says the shooter got back in the van, drove off. At the scene, investigators found a mountain bike and a handgun they say belongs to the victim. They say he did not have a permit to carry.
A man was shot in the face in East Germantown, then tried to drive himself to the hospital. Happened just after midnight near Germantown Ave in Church Lane. The guy was sitting in a caddy with his girlfriend when someone walked up and fired 14 shots at the car. The man was hit in the cheek, but Captain Timothy Steffen says somehow they missed the girl.
Unknown how she didn't get hit. Obviously, she was the passenger of the car with 14 rounds going into the car. Only luckily, by the grace of God, that the driver was the only person struck inside that vehicle.
The man tried to drive himself to the hospital, got about five blocks down Germantown Ave, where he waved down an officer who was directing traffic. The officer took him to the hospital in his patrol car. The shooter seen running into an alleyway. Police are checking surveillance video to try to identify him.
On Wednesday, the station reported on this case involving alleged murder and fire.
A 38-year-old woman has been charged with murder, accused of setting a fire that killed a man and displaced a dozen others Monday afternoon in North Philadelphia. KYW's crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson has the details.
Natasha Teague faces murder, arson, and a dozen counts of both risking and causing catastrophe and reckless endangerment charges in Monday's fire that killed a 69-year-old man and damaged six homes. Deputy Police Commissioner Frank Van Noor says it started over an argument.
She was living there. Also, one of the witnesses was living there, and she was occupying the house in the recent, and I think this argument involved her leaving, and she didn't want to leave that residence.
He says Teague tried to start another fire earlier in the morning, and then again around 1 in the afternoon, she succeeded. Venor says the home, located on Percy Street right off of Rising Sun Avenue near Erie Avenue, went up quickly, and people in the neighboring homes were trapped. But firefighters were able to put it out and pull everyone to safety, except Barry Turner, who was pronounced dead at the scene.
The fire definitely spread, which is always dangerous when we're talking about row homes. It quickly could spread, so very dangerous situation.
Teague has a lengthy criminal record in other states, including drugs, burglary, retail theft, criminal trespassing, forgery, hindering apprehension, and a gun charge. Now she faces murder. Kristen Johansson, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
According to reporting from the Associated Press, a cult-like group called the Zizians has been linked to multiple murders across the United States. A 2025 report from the AP said that the group's goals were unclear, but that their writing spanned topics from radical veganism and gender identity to artificial intelligence. Now, another case has been linked to the Zizians. KYW reported on it this Wednesday.
Authorities in Delaware County have charged a woman connected to a cult-like group with the 2022 New Year's Eve murder of her parents. KYW's Matt Coughlin joins us now live from Delaware County.
The district attorney's office here in Delaware County says 33-year-old Michelle Zajko is charged with the murder on New Year's Eve of her parents, Richard and Rita. Zajko is a member, reportedly, of the Zizians, a cult-like group of computer scientists that have been connected to murders in California, Vermont, and now Delaware County. As authorities announced the arrest this afternoon, Roseanne Zajko, Michelle's aunt and Richard's sister, spoke to the media.
We don't know yet if the trial will begin to heal the void in us and the ache in our hearts, but we do know that the detectives, the DA's office, and we, the family, have done everything possible to achieve justice for Rita and Rick.
The district attorney, Tanner Roos, he says investigators pieced together evidence, including ring camera audio of someone saying mom outside the Zajko home shortly before the murder. Police discovered shell casings recovered at the crime scene. They were later able to match those shell casings to shell casings found at Michelle Zajko's home in Vermont, where she lived at the time. And they also have messages between Zajko and others where Zajko discusses the mistakes she believes she made. This is according to police, of course, mistakes that she says she made when her parents were killed. Roos says it's unclear, Raquel, when the murder case will move forward. Zajko is facing charges in Western Maryland of trespassing and firearms.
All right, Matt, thank you. That's KYW's Matt Coughlin joining us live from Delaware County.
In another report this week, KYW provided an update to a murder case linked to Temple University.
A Philadelphia man accused of killing a Temple University student 2 years ago has been sentenced to 15 to 40 years in prison. Tymir Lackey pleaded guilty in March to third-degree murder in the killing of Milan Jones, who was about to enter his third year of college. The murder happened in 2024, a few blocks south from Temple's campus. Jones was found unresponsive with blunt force trauma to the head, and Lackey was arrested on scene. He was a student as well, but had been suspended from campus.
In the Midwest, the victim of a decades-old case has finally been identified. Here's Odyssey station WBBM News Radio in Chicago with the news this week.
In 1975, Clinton, Iowa sheriff's deputies responded to a report and found a dead teenager in the Mississippi River, but she could not be identified. After an autopsy, the death was ruled a homicide. The Clinton Sheriff's Office now says Cheryl Lynn Edwards of Waukegan was positively identified through forensic genealogy. Iowa officials say the new technology means the homicide investigation can proceed. Edwards' family has been notified. Roger Plummer, News Radio, 105.9 WBBM.
WBBM also reported on an interesting development in the Starved Rock killer case this week.
Attorneys for Chester Weaker are asking Governor Pritzker to grant a posthumous pardon nearly a year after the convicted Starved Rock killer died at the age of 86. Weaker confessed to the 1960 killings of three women at Starved Rock State Park, but was only convicted in one of those murders. He later claimed the confession was coerced and maintained his innocence for decades. His attorney now argues the killings were part of a murder-for-hire plot and has filed a petition with the Illinois Prisoner Review Board seeking to clear Uyghur's name. Rachel Pearson, News Radio, 105.9 WBBM.
In Minnesota, there's been a date set for the sentencing of a man convicted of attacking multiple Democratic lawmakers. Odyssey station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities reported.
The federal judge presiding over Vance Belter's murder case will sentence him later this summer. Court documents show Belter is scheduled to appear before Judge John Thunheim at the federal courthouse in Minneapolis on July 23rd at 10 a.m. Earlier this month, Belter pleaded guilty to shooting and killing Minnesota House Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark, and critically injuring State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette.
The trial for a 30-year-old man accused of setting a blaze that eventually grew into a massive wildfire in the Los Angeles area last year ended in a mistrial this week. Odyssey station KNX News in Los Angeles had the details.
A defeat, a major defeat for the government. That's how the attorney for Jonathan Rinderknecht described this mistrial in the arson case against the defendant. He'd been accused of starting the Lockman fire New Year's Day 2025, a week later after smoldering underground. It's believed to have sparked the Palisades fire disaster. Jurors told the judge they were deadlocked. Deadlocked 10, not guilty. Just 2 convinced the defendant was guilty. Here's one of the not guilty jurors.
We couldn't come to an agreement. It just wasn't happening.
What led you to the not guilty conclusion?
There's just not enough proof. It was just happened so late in time, and I just felt like
a lot of holes.
The prosecution did lack any evidence of a person or security video, something that actually showed the defendant starting the fire. The judge did declare the mistrial, and on social media, the U.S. Attorney's Office vowed practically before the courtroom was empty that there would be a retrial. The defendant's attorney says this case has become highly political.
He was encouraged that the jury heard the evidence for 2.5 weeks and pretty resoundingly found that the government's case was not strong and they didn't have enough evidence to convict him. So obviously an acquittal would have been preferred, but a hung jury on a 10-2 verdict, to be frank, in most districts, you're not going to have a retrial, but you will in this district.
Why is that?
Well, he tweeted out, apparently, Bill Asaley, while we were in the courtroom, he tweeted out that he was going to retry the case. So that tells you kind of what's going on with what they do in this district in terms of making charging decisions. I believe the evidence was overwhelming at trial, and the jury did too, that there was not enough evidence to convict Jonathan.
For a time, the judge was contemplating freeing the defendant ahead of his retrial. Eventually, she decided against it, the retrial, Brian. It's now set for October 19th.
Attorney Rachel Fizay joined KNX News' Margaret Carrero to further discuss what's going on with this case.
Did it surprise you that the judge declared this mistrial so early after something like 13 hours of deliberations?
It really did not. And that has a lot to do with the emotional plea that the prosecution made throughout. So I believe the judge really did not truly in her heart perhaps believe that this should be a prosecution verdict. And she also probably believed that people were really digging in their heels and that more deliberation would be fruitless.
You know, one juror was speaking to reporters after this all went down this morning and said that a majority during their deliberations was always not guilty. As we heard from our Craig Figner at the very end, it was 10 jurors in favor of acquittal. What do you make of that? And why were they leaning toward not guilty?
The evidence in this case was scant and all circumstantial. And by circumstantial, I mean there was literally not a piece of direct evidence that would tie Rinderknecht to actually starting this fire that burned 7 days later to cause this devastation. And I think that was fairly glaringly obvious throughout this prosecution. At the same time, people wanted someone to blame. There were, emotional pleas. There was circumstantial evidence that perhaps this defendant's state of mind might have been such that he would start a fire. So I think you really had polarizing testimony from both sides, and the arguments from both sides were really just playing into very specific but different parts of people's emotions.
You know, when the mistrial was declared, it wasn't very long after that that the first assistant U.S. attorney, Bill Esaley, took to X and announced that his office will retry the case. Is that typical when the vast majority of jurors want to acquit, or do prosecutors just normally just accept defeat?
Well, often prosecutors will say they're going to retry a case after a mistrial, but it doesn't happen. If I am the U.S. attorney at this point, I am going back to the drawing board. I am wondering what has to be done differently in order to get a win. And that includes changing the charges if that's what needs to be done. And I also believe they would be re-entering plea negotiations, because right now the defense has the upper hand and all they have to do is come back and basically put on the exact same case to either get a defense verdict or another mistrial.
When it comes to retrials, are they generally successful?
Retrials can be successful. It does happen for sure. But what happens is new evidence. Like, there has to be something done differently. So at this point, they have to find new evidence. They reopen the investigation and they look for that smoking gun, if you will, something that will convince a jury that he is guilty.
Now we're diving into a vintage crime case. Annie McCormick is a former TV broadcaster and a longtime Philadelphia journalist. When she found out about a murder in her beloved hometown of Moorestown, New Jersey, McCormick soon found herself investigating the century-old crime. It's a story that starts in a Moorestown mansion, where Ruth Wilson and her former fiancé, Horace Reds Roberts, both just 24 years old, were discovered barely alive after suffering gunshot wounds to the head. While detectives at the time thought that Reds might be the culprit, his own wounds pushed away easy explanations. What followed was an investigation with many twists and turns that eventually drew the attention of an investigator dubbed America's Sherlock Holmes, and mysteries around it linger to this day. McCormick joined KYW's Christian Johansson this week to discuss her new book on the case. It's called Restless Ghosts: Murder, Suicide, and the Case That Wouldn't Stay Buried.
So tell me a little bit about the crime.
So there's two crimes in the book. The first crime is 1929. There's two socialites that are found shot and dying in a mansion in Moorestown. They are a couple that had been off and on. They had been engaged. They broke up. They were engaged again and they broke up. So that was ruled a murder-suicide. And the theory is that Ruth Wilson, who was one of the victims, had again denied advances from her longtime off and on again fiance boyfriend, who is Horace Reds Roberts. So they determine right away without an autopsy that it is a murder-suicide. The problem is, once there was pressure put on them by local police and also the media to look further into the murder-suicide, because immediately they determined that he was shot at least three times in the head, they then had to have what they called back then a coroner's inquest. And in a coroner's inquest, you basically get a small jury. It's almost similar to what a grand jury would be today. But they had to get a jury, and then they had to dig up the bodies because they had never initially performed an autopsy. And so then they had to perform the autopsies. And when they performed the autopsy, they found that he wasn't shot three times in the head. He was shot four times in the head. But the verdict of the coroner's inquest was, again, a murder-suicide. And at the time, you know, people are still scratching their heads. How can you say this? But then it just went away. Everyone said, okay, you know, due process was done. Let's move on. Well, in 1933, their friend from growing up and also Reds's college roommate is found murdered in a house in Cinnaminson where he had moved from Morristown to Cinnaminson, where he lived with his wife and his young daughter. But he too was a Morristown socialite and had grown up catty corner from Ruth Wilson in another Morristown mansion. So immediately everybody starts to say, wait a minute, this has to be connected. And prior to his death, Bradway Brown, who's the victim in 1933, he started telling people. People were saying that he said, I believe that there was a double murder. I believe that Horace Reds Roberts and Ruth Wilson were murdered. There was all these rumors surrounding that where he was looking into it and saying that. So immediately everybody's like, oh my God, these have to be connected. So the 1933 murder investigation is happening, but at the same time, it's reopening the 1929 investigation. And it's the same investigator tasked with both investigations, and he's famous. He already was famous. He was called America's Sherlock Holmes. His name is Ellis Parker, and he was the chief detective of the Burlington County Prosecutor's Office. He had actually been tapped by the FBI at some points to solve other crimes in America. That's how famous he was. It was a big deal to him because he felt, I have to prove the murder-suicide was the murder-suicide, and I got to solve this other crime. In the end, he feels vindicated with the decisions that are made, and then he falls in infamy because of the Lindbergh baby case, which is another twist that comes in between both of the crimes, between 1929 and 1933, because the Lindbergh baby kidnapping happened in 1932.
Why did you pick this case?
So I grew up in Morristown, and I love my hometown, and I thought I knew so much about Morristown's extensive history. So when I read an article in the New York Daily News in 2021, I think my brother sent it to me, I thought, how did I never hear about this? And I know all these locations, and the locations are still there today. They're in pristine condition. All of the houses, the original Morristown Town Hall where the coroner's inquest was held, the mortuary, the graveyards, everything is still there. So when I started reading about it, and I'm in Morristown often, I couldn't help but constantly look around and think, wow, like this happened there and this happened there. And the more I read about it, which I had to do all through really old newspapers, the more newspapers I found, not expecting to find new angles, I kept finding new twists to the case. There's even more twists and turns than just what I explain in a synopsis. And there's already twists and turns in the synopsis. So it's like I fell down this rabbit hole. And each newspaper and each year that I'm still reading more information about the two different cases and the impact on the community and the town and how the town basically is wondering if the justice system even works, I needed to know the answer. I needed to know the conclusion. And at the same time, I'm covering modern day cases that are reflecting what happened almost 100 years ago. And you think by now you wouldn't have cases like that, that you wouldn't have doubt in cases today with all the advances we have in technology compared to cases 100 years ago, but you do. And so some of the cases I was covering, like the Ellen Greenberg case and, you know, other cases where there's just a ton of doubt surrounding it, it made me even more interested in how do you get doubt, right? What causes the doubt in a case to make it be reopened? How does that happen in cases? And so that's why I really wanted to read Soup to Nuts, everything about both of these crimes. It's nonfiction, so you can't make up your own ending. But towards the end of it, I think the reader is left with a lot of questions, and I want the reader to come to their own conclusion. I don't ever, as a journalist, want to tell people what I think or where my head's at, because to be honest with you, I go back and forth. I vacillate on a lot of these verdicts and you know, in the cases that we cover in modern day and even this one, because when you hear new evidence or when you hear a new angle that comes through, you have to stop, take a step back and think, how does this impact this case that I'm reporting on? I mean, I think that that's the responsible thing to do. So even with this case, you know, I think, okay, all of the elements of him committing a murder-suicide are there. It's unrequited love, the weapon they were able to identify that he actually had that type of gun. But again, he shot four times in the head. How can you shoot yourself four times in the head? It's interesting too what the theories from investigators are for him to do that. They actually refer to the gun as a toy gun, and it's not. It's an actual gun.
There's so much detail in it too. Where do you pull that some of it? It's just so detailed. You describe the blood on the dad. Can you explain a little bit of like how much research goes into this?
And that's the part, it's the detail that takes the longest, because you want to make sure that you're gathering enough research that you have all the angles. So I relied most heavily on newspaper archives. And what was great back then is there was so much space in newspapers. So you had, reporters had more space that they could use. And the coroner's inquest was actually printed in full in the newspaper. So I have firsthand accounts of all of the people that were involved, and it's in a court proceeding. So that was tremendously helpful, because I have from the major players what they did that night, where they were, what actions they took, what actions they didn't take. That was very, very helpful. And then I have all the different perspectives of the newspaper reporting. And what's interesting is in 1929, it got a lot of press coverage from our local newspapers. And there was a New York Times or New York Daily News article here and there. But in 1933, when the Bradway Brown killing happened, and the 1929 cases reopened, well, it was at a different time period where a lot of, you know, detective magazines were big. And I guess at that time, the newspapers were really, tabloids were really big, and the detective books were really big. So there was more coverage of both cases. So I found out even more about the 1929 case in 1933, just based on more reporting. The New York Daily News reported on it extensively. The New York Times reported on it extensively. And in fact, it was never mentioned in 1929 that Bradway Brown and Ruth Wilson at one time had dated, but the New York Times started reporting that in 1933. And so there was a lot that I was able to take from the 1933 reporting that I had never seen in 1929. Now, when it came to when I'm describing the weddings, when I'm describing a lot of their social life and the socialite activity, all of that was printed in the newspapers back then. You know, they didn't have social media. They didn't have Facebook. They had some pictures, but obviously they're not color pictures, but they describe the wedding party's dresses and their outfits in such detail, because that was really important then. It was a big deal for somebody's socialite wedding to be printed in the newspaper. And they also would print who's having dinner with who. And it would be all the prominent people, you know, who's, you know, the Wilsons are having dinner with this judge on Friday evening at their home. Like, who would ever write that today? But back then, they thought that was important. Where are you going to summer? Well, the Wilsons will be summering in Florida in February, which is actually stupid, because then people would go like rob their houses. I think because back then the media landscape was different. You relied so heavily on the newspapers. The only other medium was really radio. And maybe when you go to a movie, at the motion picture at the end of it or beginning of it, they have newsreels, but the newsreels were national. So the media landscape was so different back then, and newspapers dominated it, that that's really how to get the bulk of my reporting. I also went to the New Jersey State Archives to try to get court records. And what's interesting is in the New Jersey State Archives, they do have court records from the 1934 trial for the 1933 murder, but they don't have anything for the coroner's inquest. And I don't know if it's at that time, they just didn't have that on the record, or was something that they just didn't keep in their files. Sometimes I would run into walls where I would be getting somewhere and then I couldn't get the answer if the newspaper was just done reporting on it. That's kind of where the end of the road was. But there's also a couple books. Ellis Parker had a couple books written about him. One was one of these detective books. That was a big thing back then, the detective magazines, the detective books, and where he regales on all of his big cases that he's covered. And in this one book about him, he goes in detail about Bradway Brown's murder. And that's how I was able to recreate when he arrived to the crime scene and his responses and who else was there and the conversations they were having versus what the media was reporting on. So I was able to have Ellis Parker's firsthand accounts from that in addition to what he said in the inquest. And so, yeah, so that's what I relied on. Cool. So a lot of that, but it was a lot of reading. In fact, there's 7 pages of endnotes, which is that's a lot because these are real people. It's 100 years ago, but they're real people. They still have family members. I want to be fair to everybody. I don't want them misquoted. And the newspapers are so old that some of them that were scanned, you can't see completely. So I actually had them sent to a transcription service that transcribed them into Word documents to make sure that I wouldn't misquote anyone. It was really important to me to make sure that everything was right and true and accurate, just like I would report on a modern day crime.
Are there still family members of these people that are around that you maybe spoke to?
So they're Bradway Brown's granddaughter is still alive. His daughter just passed away a year ago. Lovely family, didn't really want to be involved, but, you know, told me a few things about their family and they're great. And I just wanted to loop them in because I didn't want any surprises. And just like I would in a modern day crime, I wanted to be respectful to the victims and to their families.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to 1010 Winds in New York, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, WBBM News Radio in Chicago, WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, KNX News in Los Angeles, The Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, KCBS Radio in San Francisco, and A New Morning out of WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these true crime roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.